Welcome to the Specialty Coffee Podcast by Storyline Coffee Roasters. We are so excited about our guest today. We have Kyle here with us. He started out in coffee with Strava Coffee, which was a kind of four-year deal he did there. He then went to Huckleberry and is now doing an internship with a producer down in Mexico. So, Kyle, we are so excited to have you on. And a quick note to all of our followers before we jump in. I always forget to do this. First and foremost, thank you for listening. Thank you guys for subscribing. If you guys can leave us a review, I do listen to every review that you guys write, and it means a lot. So if you guys find some value in this episode, be sure to share. But anyways, Kyle, thanks for jumping on and chatting with us about your experience in coffee.
Yeah, Tyler, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it'll be great. You came highly recommended, so I'm sure you've got a wealth of knowledge. But how did you find yourself in the specialty coffee world?
Yeah, kind of a sort of a long story. During my undergrad studies at CU Boulder, I studied international affairs. And through that, I had a professor who used coffee supply chains as kind of like a good example or a window to show students like how an export commodity like coffee can be an important driver of development, as well as an important foreign exchange earner, and just how it could be a lens to understand international commerce, especially as it exists between countries that countries that produce different products, right? Mm. Somewhere like the US that maybe exports mostly information, and somewhere like a Latin American country that exports what are often referred to as primary products as their major foreign exchange earners.
Yeah.
Yeah. So got introduced to coffee that way. Thought it was super interesting. Was like, whoa, this is great. This is a great way for me to kind of have some continuity in how I learn about international affairs, international economics, and trade and stuff. So after that class, every time I had an open-ended research project, I tried to fall back into coffee and use coffee in whatever way I could to kind of fit it into whatever that project may have been. Ended up looking at like a lot of different labeling initiatives like Fair Trade, Rainforest Alliance, and that sort of thing to try and use coffee as a way for myself to understand how a globally traded product could perhaps be used as an engine of improving livelihoods for people all over the world. Right. So I got all these esoteric ideas in college. I thought I had the answer. I thought fair trade was it. I read a little bit more. I learned that there are some inefficiencies involved with being a fair trade certified organization that maybe make it not the answer, right? Okay. If it's not the answer, let's explore what else is out there. Let me, you know, I want to get more into it. I wanted to explore what other models people were pursuing and what was going on in the world of coffee, right? I knew that I had only kind of scratched the surface in school, and so I said, hey, I should work in coffee to maybe see what it's actually like, right? And so through some connections I had in Denver, I got connected with a guy named Leo Sedaris. Shout out to Leo. He was the head roaster at Strava Craft Coffee at the time. He was willing to hire me, train me how to roast, teach me how to cup, and just kind of give me my in to coffee through Strava. So I got started there. I started cupping. Strava had a direct-ish trading relationship with a particular exporter in Colombia. And so from that, I got an idea of like, how do people actually buy coffee? What does that look like? What does it mean for the people on the other end of the supply chain? How are they operating to achieve their goals? What's going on here, right? And then at the same time, I learned a little bit about roasting and a little bit about cupping and a whole lot of it about running a roastery in a very small startup environment that was growing rapidly or pursuing rapid growth. So kind of got my feet wet in a lot of different things there at Strava. And did that for a few years, was stoked on it. Strava's focus is on CBD infused coffee beverages. And that's a particular niche that they've carved out for themselves and was not necessarily the direction I wanted to keep going in coffee. So I started looking for opportunities to kind of get more into specialty coffee, right? Because at this point it had dawned on me that like, okay, pushing quality is like a common thread, no matter what narrative or not narrative, whatever model people use or choose to try and use coffee to improve livelihoods for producing people. Pushing quality is a common thread, right? Okay, let's learn a little bit more about what quality is, how people achieve it. So I started looking for other jobs, came across Huckleberry and knew that they were into quality. They've got a super robust buying program at Huckleberry. Kevin there does some really rad things with a whole lot of groups all over the world in Latin America and Africa. I was lucky enough to get hired on there by Shelby. Shout out to Shelby. Learned a ton while I was there at Huckleberry. Learned a lot from Kevin, learned a lot from Shelby. Learned a ton about coffee, cupping, different processing methods, different origins, how and why all of that stuff matters. And also even more about roasting. Shelby's, you know, U.S. roasting champ, knows a ton about it. Kevin's got a number of years under his belt roasting as well. And like, so through working with them and through working with a couple of different machines, moving warehouses, going from an old Probat to a brand new Loring at Huckleberry, just got a ton of exposure there. From there, I decided, hey, this is all great. I kind of feel like I have a grasp of a lot of the stuff that goes on the roasting side or on the consuming end of the coffee supply chain. I want to know what goes on in the producing side, where it's actually grown, where it's exported from. Came across my current internship, found myself in Mexico, hanging out with a producing organization for the harvest.
That's awesome. That's yeah, you've had quite the history in coffee. What are you doing? What's been the most eye-opening piece about going to Mexico and seeing the producing side of things with kind of a pretty extensive background, I think, from like an American perspective, right? Like you had done a lot of things in college. You had probably been involved somewhat on the direct relationships with different companies. But what was that like actually now, boots on the ground in Mexico?
I think a common thing since I first got interested into coffee is that every time I learn something, I learn how much more fucking complicated it is. Like it's all, yes, all of it, dude. Yeah. Right. Like, so true, like man. I started in college. I was like, yo, fair trade's the answer. Like we got it. Sweet. They figured it out. We just got to get more people to get fair trade certified. That's the answer. I read 3 more research papers. I learned that there's all sorts of like administrative costs and certification costs that kind of mess up the efficiency sometimes with fair trade. So maybe it doesn't always make the most sense for all producing organizations to do that, right? Every step of the way, I've learned how much more complicated things are. And I think throughout my experience here in Mexico, I've really, the biggest piece of perspective I've gained is how complicated it is. The group I work with right now organizes around 400 to 500 producers to move coffee every season, right? And you think about that and you're like, whoa, that's like you got 400 to 500 producers. When they say that, they mean that 400 to 500 farmers, right? But working with those farmers are a handful of pickers. There's 6 or 7 reception points where coffee's being processed and dried. There's a handful of people that work there. There's a handful of people in the office. So they've got all these moving parts that like, wow, I knew it was complicated, but to realize what it really takes to get, you know, that 150-pound sack of beans into your roastery has been, yeah.
Yeah, it's, I think what's fascinating is, like, I think with the USDA organic is similar, right? I often get people that are like, oh, I like, do you have organic coffee? And mm-hmm. I don't think people fully understand that, like, fair trade, which to be fair, like, I don't think I fully understood the shortcomings, I guess, of fair trade, but organic mm-hmm. is kind of the same thing, right? Like, it's difficult to be an organic coffee producer, and there's a lot of challenges mm-hmm. that come with that and can be burdensome to the farmer and is actually not beneficial at the end. And I don't think people fully understand that. You know, it's kind of like America does a really good job of buzzword marketing deals that actually, when you kind of peel back the layers, are like, huh, that's maybe not quite so great. other than the cost and kind of things like that, what is it with fair trade that you had kind of discovered in college and things that it made you think that it wasn't the answer?
I mean, I guess there, so when you become fair trade certified, every person in the value chain, in order to sell a product to the end consumer as fair trade, every person in the value chain needs to be certified by the Fair Trade Labeling Organization or Fair Trade USA. Depends on what time period you're looking at and where you are. Whole other like level of complication. But basically, in order to be certified, there's a whole set of rules you have to comply with, right? And while those rules on the surface seem to make a lot of sense, and a lot of them do make a lot of sense, they sometimes introduce an extra layer of kind of bureaucratic complication that you have to comply with. So like one of them is for an organization under the Fair Trade Labeling Organization. I could be butchering this a little bit because it's been a number of years, but for a producing organization to be certified, they have to be organized as a cooperative, a democratically run cooperative, right? And it's one thing if you and 100 of your neighbors want to group your coffee together and sell it and export it out of wherever you may be, right? It's another thing to formalize all of the structures that you need to actually comply with the fair trade requirements on being a democratically run organization. So while it's a good idea, I like the idea on the surface of it of like, hey, you know, everyone gets a fair vote. You democratically organize your leadership, you have changeover in leadership, that sort of thing. It's sometimes a pain in the butt to get a whole bunch of people into one room and, you know, have records of what you're doing. And next thing you know, you're paying three or four administrative staff to kind of run your democratic organization rather than you and your buddies just doing stuff on a handshake. Yeah. So that's kind of like, in a nutshell, the kind of complication it adds. But yeah, another, you know, drawback to it is the certification cost, right? You're going to get a premium for being certified fair trade, but you got to turn around and send some of that premium back to the Fair Trade Labeling Organization so that they can come and do an audit. Who's going to hang out with the auditor while they're in town? Who's going to show them around, have all the connections to make sure they see what they want to see? Like, that ends up being somebody's time, which costs money, right? And so how many of these costs can you bear while still, you know, turning a profit on the premium that you're getting?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a conversation with a guy recently, and he, and Shelby and I kind of talked briefly about this, but there's a lot of issues when it comes to how coffee is, I guess, how the producers or farmers are paid for their coffee, right? So essentially, it's unlike anything that we understand in America. Like, it's not that I say, hey, my jar of coffee is $16, and customers then find value in that and want to buy the jar for $16. Instead, someone else is telling them, hey, I'll pay you $2.50 per pound or per kilo for your coffee. And, you know, based off the defects and everything else, like, this is what you're going to get. And that's totally backwards from what we're used to. And so the question that was asked to me, which I thought was really great, was how do you fix that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people are trying to figure that out, right? How do we move from a buyer-driven market to a producer one?
Right.
The orthodox economist that was schooled into me in North America at my public university says that you've got to bring in some scarcity, right? You've got to, and like in a theoretical sense, that might be great, right? The less coffee there is, the more the people who have coffee get to say, here's what you're going to pay me for it.
Right.
Right. Right. The big problem with that is it's kind of backwards to say, we got to stop making so much coffee, right?
Like, right.
That's not going to work, right? Totally. So the question then still stands, how do we shift the power structure here? The other, I guess, answer that I've come across thus far, and I'm not going to say anything is the answer, but it's the other reply that I've come across, is by educating producers, right? an idea that was given to me by Daniel Mendoza was that in the tea industry, it's, you know, Daniel. Mm-hmm. good buddy of mine. Shout out to him. His example was that in the tea industry, and I don't know anything about tea, so I could be butchering this, but the idea was producers know what they've got. They're able to say, here's my product. I know what good tea is. I know that I produced it well, and I can tell you that you're going to pay me X amount for it, or I'm looking to sell it for X amount, right? And a big part of that is that the producers are familiar with, I guess, need to be familiar with the whole value chain to kind of contextualize what they've got. And I think in coffee, we're starting to see that happen, at least in some of the like quarterly origin reports that I've read from various importing groups. A lot of them have been noting a decoupling of specialty prices from commodity prices. Mm. So it used to be that like your specialty price was like C plus X. It was based on a differential or something like that.
Yeah.
And in some places, the C market might be flying around all over the place, and the quality or the specialty price is just something else. Mm. And I'm suspicious that signals that some people are realizing, like, I've got good stuff. I sold it for $4 a pound last year. Sold it for $4 a pound the year before. I'm going to try and sell it for $4 a pound again this year.
Right.
You know, I don't have anything to really confirm that, but I'm like suspicious/hopeful that that's kind of the case.
Totally. Yeah. Can you explain how that market fluctuates in price for people that don't understand that essentially coffee is a commodity and there's a fluctuating price, kind of like gas?
Yeah. Let's see if I can explain futures and commodities in a nutshell on the podcast.
Yeah, no, that's no small task, man.
And to be fair, I might mess it up a little bit, right? Because this is something that I've kind of been trying to teach myself over the past 4 years, right? Sure. Because from getting into coffee, it's been made known to me from like the research papers I read in college and that kind of thing, that coffee prices are governed by contracts that are traded on an open market. And what it essentially is, where do I start with this? How do I make it concise? basically, if you're interested in buying a container of coffee, and you don't need that container until 6 months from now, one of the ways that you could get the rights to a container of coffee is to buy a contract with the International Commodities Exchange, ICE, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that contract is called a futures contract, and it'll carry a price that basically I'm going to buy it like... I'm already messing this up. It basically carries a fixed price per pound for the coffee that's going to come in that container in 6 months.
Right.
And so if you have that contract, you have the right to a container full of coffee at, let's say, I think right now we're like $1.85. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Somewhere around there. You have the right to a container full of coffee, which is like 35,000 pounds or it's 250 bags. You have the right to like all of that coffee at $1.50 a pound. Whether or not other people are buying and selling coffee at, you know, that price you agreed on, which I think I just decided was $1.50, is in 6 months, whether or not people are buying and selling coffee at $1.50 a pound doesn't matter. You have this contract, you have the right to that coffee.
Right.
And so let's say in 6 months or 5 months and 29 days, it turns out that people are buying and selling coffee at $1.80 a pound. You can then take your contract, which is your right to coffee at $1.50 a pound, and sell that right to somebody else. And that other person now, rather than having to buy coffee at $1.80 a pound on the open market, suddenly has the right to cheaper coffee.
Yeah.
So that's like kind of a futures contract in a nutshell, right?
Yeah, it was great.
We iterate this over time and over a whole bunch of contracts, and suddenly people are trading the right to buy a certain amount of coffee from a certain place at a certain point in time in the future at a certain price. And people, large players, both like coffee companies and just speculative financial institutions, buy and sell the rights to coffee at a certain price at a certain time, as a way to maybe limit their losses or make some money against the real coffee they have to buy. I don't know if that makes sense. So basically, all these people are trading each other the right to a certain amount of coffee at a certain price at a certain time in the future from a certain place, right?
Right.
And these people are deciding, like to give a concrete example, let's say I have a futures contract for Brazilian coffee or for a container of Brazilian coffee in 4 months from now. So in theory, I could buy this container of Brazilian coffee, and it's like generic Brazilian coffee. I'm not going to know what farm it came from. I'm not going to know what dry mill it came from. I'm not going to know anything about it, right? I'm just going to know it came from Brazil and it meets a minimum quality standard. I've got this right for container of generic Brazilian coffee sometime in the future at $1.60 a pound. Turns out that there was a frost in Brazil and the trees are frozen, and it's going to be really hard to get Brazilian coffee in 6 months or in 4 months, I think, was the arbitrary thing I just decided on in this example.
Yeah.
Turns out it's going to be really hard to get. And so suddenly in 4 months, Brazilian coffee is going to be worth $2 a pound, $2.50 a pound. I can either take my cheap coffee, because maybe I need coffee, maybe my roastery needs coffee. Or I can find somebody else who really needs coffee and be like, hey, I got the right to get it at $1.50 a pound. It's even cheaper. But in order to get that right for me, you've got to pay me, I don't know, a few thousand bucks or something, right?
Yeah.
Not exactly how the contracts are traded, but that's what's going on, right? And so by selling this contract, I made X amount of money from whoever I sold it to, and now it doesn't hurt so bad for me to go buy that $2.50 a pound Brazilian coffee in 4 months.
Right.
Yeah.
So essentially, do you feel like the answer would be instead of, I mean, I feel like there will probably always be that, because you're just going to have massive companies that are going to be buying massive contracts in large quantities. Do you feel like an answer is for specialty to be more of a free market, small lot or small producer or small co-op, I guess would be another way to say it, to whatever level that goes to, and say, hey, you know, this producer is working on experimental processing or really good quality control. You know, these are the past, you know, green quality scores that it's gotten in cupping scores. And, you know, we can now say that this coffee is going to be this much. And then I think my biggest question is, how do you get people in the United States? Because even myself, I'm like, how do I get relationships to where I can then purchase coffee to where it actually benefits the producer? How can I get that direct trade, free market, smaller scale? Is that the answer as opposed to this large scale commodity futures?
I think that can be some of the answer. I think something I've struggled with trying to figure out right now is, like, people are accustomed to cheap coffee. Coffee is widely available. You can get it for a dollar a cup at McDonald's or, you know, whatever. Sometimes it's free at the gas station if you buy a big enough tank of gas. Like, I don't know.
Yep.
But people are accustomed to that, right?
Totally.
And some people don't care about quality. Like, to put it bluntly and as sad as it is, like, some people just don't, right? They just want to get caffeined out and make it to lunch. Like, that's right. And so the big question I'd put to myself is, like, is there a way to take that side of the market and make it so that it still works for producers? Because, like, to go back to the futures contracts a little bit, those contracts exist so that people can try and avoid some of the risk associated with the fluctuating prices by, like, locking in a future price for themselves, or locking in a future price that they don't actually need, but being able to sell that price and make a few bucks and then cushion the losses when prices go up sometime later. Like futures contracts exist for oil, corn, all sorts of largely traded commoditized agricultural goods. But, right, so, like, I guess the thing I'm wrestling with, right, is that there's always going to be this split. And we see specialty coffee, like you mentioned, kind of being an avenue for higher wages for producers, right? Because people recognize the quality and suddenly they're trading a product that's separated from the commodity market where the quality is recognized mm-hmm. and prices aren't affected so much by supply and demand as they are about, or as they are by, you know, just like differentiation, I guess, between the product, being able to say that my stuff's unique compared to the person down the road, compared to the person in another country, right? And people are seeing reward for that. So like, while that's working to kind of bring up, or appears to be working to bring improve livelihoods for some people, I guess the open question for me remains, like, if that's one avenue, it's never going to represent 100% of the market, because there's all these other people who are accustomed to and just want cheap coffee. Like, don't care, dude.
Right.
Like,
yeah. I want my filter. Like, just leave me alone.
Yeah,
which is fine.
Exactly. And like, dude, yeah. Right. Cause like, I mean, I think about this with like the clothes I buy, right? Like
totally.
I want to know that like whoever sewed my clothes wasn't mistreated and wasn't, you know, or like was able to have a prosperous or, you know, decent life for themselves. But at the end of the day, I might need a t-shirt, man.
Like, I know, yeah.
You know, yeah.
And I'm not the person who wants to spend $30 or $40 for a t-shirt. I'm like, man, like, can I just get a $5 t-shirt? Like, you know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah, that's the reality, right, that we live in. So I don't know. I think the biggest question for me is, like, how can people in the world continue to live the material reality that they're accustomed to while also making sure that it doesn't depend on something that more or less amounts to exploitation or is unnecessarily unjust.
Right. 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. That.
Yeah. And I just feel like there will probably always be a place for coffee. There will always be that need for cheap, like your Starbucks companies are always going to get massive quantities of coffee at insanely cheap prices. That's probably never mm-hmm. going to go away, right? Like you have your grocery store coffees that are always going to be there. And I think that's okay. The specialty industry, I think, I wish there was a platform that I could become accustomed to as a small to mid-size coffee roaster. I would say small, really. And it's all scale, I guess. But like, I wish there was a platform that I could get an understanding on that what I'm actually buying is actually going to benefit these producers. And maybe I'm already mm-hmm. on those, right? Like, I just don't know. And I feel like there's a lot of people that don't. Like, the most common question I honestly get from roasters that are starting out is, where do I buy coffee and how do I get it? Right. And like, because it's this weird cryptic thing that, like, you know, there's way more places, but there's like three or four that are well known. Right. And how do we have a platform in America and in other, you know, parts of the world that is accessible to those people that translates back to the producer, where you don't have to have these crazy, you know, like direct relationships where you know the farmer, you've been to origin, because that's also problematic. Like I've never been to origin and I would love to go. And that's always been a goal of mine, but like, I've got two kids and I'm busy life and it's expensive to travel there, you know? And so how do we kind of bridge that gap to where it's accessible and there's education around it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a background question that I have been trying to answer for myself as well, that kind of motivated me to do what I'm currently doing to get some perspective here at Origin, right? Like, because I've never been in a direct buying role at any of the jobs that I've had thus far, right? So I've always, like, while Kevin especially at Huckleberry and Leo at Strava were always happy to share with me and did indeed teach me a lot, there was always a limit to how much of the detail I was able to uncover, right? And part of that is because there's so many layers of I guess, abstraction that things go through, from the person who picks the coffee to, or the person who planted the tree that grew the coffee, to the person that ends up pulling a shot of espresso or, you know, brewing it on their pour over in their kitchen, right?
Right.
So like there's a lot of opacity there. But I guess, I don't know, man, it's tricky because the line between transparency and marketing, like, is right. Like people dance around it all day, and it, and because it's so complicated, it's really easy to be like, yeah, we, you know, we really did good by these people. And there's no way for someone who's, you know, stuck on the other end of the value chain, got two kids and doesn't have time to fly down to Ecuador, like,
right,
to verify that. Right.
Yep.
And even if I don't know. I don't want to put anyone on the spot, but like one of the things that I've realized in my experience here is like, even though I'm fairly comfortable operating in Spanish, it's like, even though I'm here, even though I've been here for 4 months, it's still hard to like know for sure exactly like, you know, did this person working with a particular organization, like, did they cover all their input costs, like, and have money to live the life that they wanted to last year, right? I believe in the organization where I'm working right now. I believe that they are doing well by their producers, but like, I'm not going to go around and ask all 400 of the farmers that we work with, like, how's it going, dude? You know, like, are you stoked on how things turned out last year? Like, it's just, it's legit. So there's a lot of trust that I guess has to happen.
Right.
Right. There's a lot of trust. So I guess a good place to start is to, like, if you're a roaster, to find an importer that you feel like you can trust. An importer that is willing to answer the questions that you ask them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, as time goes on, as I'm learning, like, there are all sorts of weird nitty gritty questions that you can ask if you really want to push on, you know. Yeah, if you really want to know. Yeah. And I guess by asking those questions, you know, you might rub some people the wrong way, but you might also find out who you really feel like you can trust.
Right. What importers do you feel like are good resources for people to reach out to that probably can answer those questions for one, and two, then can partner people with those relationships, mm-hmm. and or just say like, hey, this is what we're doing. This is kind of the information that we're getting, which again goes back to your marketing thing of like, there's always going to be this level of like, oh, like we care and we're making sure that the money's going there. But like at the end of the day, everyone's goal at the end of the day is to make money to support themselves. Whether that's me, whether that's the importer, whether that's the producer, the picker, the process, like all of those layers in between, the shipping, like there's so many layers. And like you started this, you know, conversation off with, it's so complicated.
Dude, but, it's so complicated.
Yeah. It's like you can take any little, like you can take espresso and go down the rabbit hole. You can take importing and go down the rabbit hole. But to go back to that, what are some importers that you feel like do a good job of being transparent and having those good relationships?
Yeah. I think so at Huck, they made a strong effort to seek out those types of importers, seek out people who are genuinely trying to make an impact and actually making an impact, right? Who had the intent, saw it through, and were doing well. So I guess this is not going to be an exhaustive list, because I'm sure that there are a lot of importers that I don't know about out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are importers who maybe have a model that isn't the same as everyone else's who are having success. But I mean, so shout out to where I'm working right now. The U.S. importing arm is called San Cristobal Coffee Importers. They're out of Kirkland, Washington. They work with a few groups around the world who all have the aim of improving producer livelihoods. And I can see, like, through where I'm working right now, that the group has successfully organized 400 people or more, 500 people here in northern Mexico, or northern coffee Mexico, to help producers improve their livelihoods. And San Cristobal has helped create a market for the coffee for those producers, so that you know, what they're doing is recognized and then valued by the purchase or the people purchasing the coffee.
Sure.
So give them a shout out. And then beyond that, I spoke recently with someone from Origin Coffee Lab who operates in Peru. They've got a slightly different model, but a model nonetheless where they are able to deliver good value to the producers whose coffee they're buying. They have also organized a relatively large producing society and have helped people drive or improve quality and use that as a driver for improving the value of, you know, their coffees. Who else? Mighty Peace is an East African importer that I'm aware of that's doing some good stuff. BD Imports in Brazil. I think, yeah, they work with mostly Black Brazilian farmers who, if you dig into the history, turns out have been particularly marginalized to help those producers reach markets where their product is particularly valued, where their hard effort or their hard work is recognized. And then, I mean, those are kind of a couple that come to mind off the top of my head. There's Campesino Coffee, who works in Colombia. That was the Colombian group that Strava worked with. And they have grown immensely over the past few years. And again, with the aim of helping producers who produce a quality product, find a market for that product and get the prices that they deserve. So yeah, those are a couple that come to mind right now.
Do you feel like for someone just starting out, like your Genuine Origin, your Cafe Imports, your Royal, your, I'm trying to think of some of the other, you know, Sweet Maria's, which is now Coffee Shrub, like those larger, like first of the list type organizations, are they a part of that kind of bigger scheme? Or do you feel like you have to go to importers that are, because importers typically do maybe one or two regions, right? Like you'll have a Colombia or you'll have a Brazil or you'll have a African, like you've mentioned. But then you've got these larger companies where me as a roaster, I can click through and say, okay, I need, you know, an Indonesian coffee. I would love a Colombian. I'd love a Brazil. And be able to see different coffees and producers there. Is that a good place for people to look if they want to be putting money back into the producers, or do you feel like it's too large scale at that level?
No, I don't want to speak too much of it because there's a limit to the ins and outs of those organizations that I'm familiar with at the moment, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But from what I have gleaned so far, they are doing the first most important thing, which is finding a market for coffees, right?
Right.
That's, if there's nowhere to sell the coffee, you're not going to get anything for it. Yep. So these importers are creating a market where the quality is prized, right? And then beyond that, I believe that they have to be doing something right because they're able to find good coffee year after year. And at the other end of the value chain, if you're producing good coffee and the person you're selling it to isn't doing it right, you probably don't have a reason to keep going back and selling your coffee to that person.
Yeah.
You might. It's complicated. There is a limited number of buyers. There's a limited number of access to information or a limited amount of access to information. Simply. But because those larger brands are able to consistently deliver on quality, I believe that they're probably doing something right.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. Yeah.
No, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
What in your role there have you found to be most encouraging that you're kind of seeing on the producing side, the processing side? Like what trends are you seeing on the ground level do you feel like are good and are exciting to you?
That's an interesting question, and it's one that I'm not sure I have an answer to 100%, right? Because one trend that I've noticed in coffee is that people like, especially with where processing's kind of going these days or has been going in the recent past, people are interested in avant-garde processing methods that present coffee in a new or different way. Like, oh my God, you made this coffee taste like bubblegum, or this tasted just like rosé, like, mm-hmm. or, you know, some of the ferment heavy coffee processing methods that you see. Or, you know, so one of the things that's driving value right now is that kind of stuff.
Right.
I personally can't drink more than one of those, like a cup of coffee, of that kind of coffee at a time, right? It's just quite literally not my cup of coffee, right? My opinion is that value, or an equal amount of value, ought to be found in reliably consistent, complex, but balanced cups of coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah. So while I think it's good that people have, by, you know, pursuing new processing methods, been able to find or create something, a product that is valued, I also have tremendous respect for people who can create consistent, clean coffee.
Totally.
And dude, honestly, like a complex, clean, washed coffee is hard to create. Like, you don't do that on accident.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've learned while I've been here is that it doesn't happen on accident at all. Especially if it's consistent, batch after batch, lot after lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I can. So. And I think my personal opinion is this, like, which I've kind of already alluded to, there's a place for everything, right? Like, I do thoroughly enjoy an experimentally processed, double fermented, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a place for that. Similar to, there's a place for funky sour beers, right? And mm-hmm. and I enjoy sours. But I also love a good light beer that is consistent and easy drinking and clean and good. And I think it's the same for coffee, right? It's the majority of the coffees that I source are balanced. They have some fruit notes. They're juicy. They're, you know, they may be naturally processed. They may be a washed coffee. But regardless, like, that's typically where I find the majority of my coffees. And then I'll kind of branch out on either side of that spectrum to go, you know, I'd really love like a full-bodied coffee. I'd really love like a crazy acidic fruit fermented or whatever coffee. Because it's fun, right? It's different, it's new. But I think there is a place for it all. I hope, and I don't foresee this happening, where the coffee industry will go to where it's just so focused on those new experimental processing methods. I think it'll have its niche in its place, but I hope that there's that middle ground.
I don't think that will ever drive 100% of the value in coffee, right? To go back to, like, can you imagine if you were the dude that showed up at McDonald's looking for your just straight up bitter flavor dollar cup of Joe and somebody handed you, like, 100%. You know, like, you'd be pissed. You'd be like,
what
who,
is this?
Like, who put the whiskey and the and the flavored vodka in my coffee? Like, what's going on here? You know?
100%.
Yeah. So, like, I think more so as much as pushing quality is important, I think that I have an inkling that driving efficiency is another important thing to do in coffee. And driving efficiency might mean a whole lot of different things. It might mean cutting out middlemen, reducing bureaucracy, making trade easier, finding, you know, like reducing the number of hands in the honeypot, I guess is a common thing that I've come or found myself coming back to thus far in my exploration of coffee, right?
Yeah.
But it, like, whether or not there are efficiencies to be squeezed out on the processing side is an open question to me, right? Like, Brazil is consistently able to produce inexpensive coffee because they've mechanized a lot of the farming that goes on there, right? And, like, while that doesn't necessarily produce a quality level that maybe appeals to the crowd that might be watching this podcast, that does make it so that someone, whoever owns the large mechanized farm, is able to do well for themselves producing coffee that ends up filling in that inexpensive channel.
Right.
Which, like, maybe it's not the romantic ideal that we want to see, but at the end of the day, somebody's doing well for themselves, like growing and selling coffee.
Yep.
That's what we wanted, right?
Exactly. Like, at the end of the day.
You know? Yeah. So, like, I'm continuing to explore what different models exist, what they mean for different people. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, right? Like, there's a place for everything, and we can't get, and again, I think here's a question that I'm hesitant to ask, but I've been wanting to ask.
Send it, because I've already made a fool of myself.
No, you haven't. You've done a great job, man. Like, and this seems ignorant, but not ignorant, but it's a maybe hard question, right? Are producers truly underpaid, or is it that we have this social justice feel that we want to believe that we need to right an injustice that actually may not be there? And I hesitate to say it, because I think the answer is obvious, that obviously it's there because people care about it and are fighting for it. But I'm just curious, like, do the producers and farmers and pickers and everyone that's involved on that side of things feel the same way that we do? Or is it this idea that, like, hey, I'm making a living and I'm getting paid and things are getting better year after year, and that's good? Or is it this thing that, like, they're struggling to pay people, they're struggling to get new sustainable ways to efficiently produce their coffees, and they, you know, are struggling at market to get what they deserve? So yeah, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah. I mean, I feel you in that, like, it's kind of hard to find the right way to pose some of these questions, right? Because the orthodox free market guy in me is like, I've kind of thought about some of these types of things and not been sure what the fairest way to pose the question is.
Right.
I guess I don't know. I think it's context dependent, and I think it's really a personal thing for, like, what, you know, whether or not you being someone who produces or picks or whatever, you know, processes coffee, like, feel like you're being fulfilled, right? Because, like, that answer is different for everybody, man. Like, some people in the U.S. don't feel like they're being fulfilled unless they're making six figures. Other people are cool to chill with 30K a year and, like, not have any problems. And, that, you know, like, they're materially set and don't have materialistic or might not have materialistic ambitions and find fulfillment elsewhere. I don't know, man.
I think that's a beautiful answer, though, because that I think does answer it for me, because the reality is that's exactly it, right? Like, what I feel like I need to make to provide for my family and the cars I wanted or whatever, right? Whatever that may be for me may not be the same for my neighbor, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with someone who, like, I drive a 2007 Dodge Dakota that's a piece of crap, and I love it, right? And that's okay. It's also okay for the guy who wants his brand new Mercedes. Like, I don't look down upon him. Like, he's done well for himself, and he should be able to enjoy the hard work that he's put in to get that Mercedes, and that's okay that he has that. I think we should care if that Mercedes was, you know, produced by slave labor or whatever else. Like, I don't think that should be right. But, you know, like, the person producing it, obviously there's a level of social equity, right? Like, you've got to be able to make sure that the people aren't being treated poorly or unpaid or, you know, child labor, whatever, right? But there's also this thing of, like, those people in Ecuador and in, you know, Guatemala or wherever it may be across the world, like, if they are happy and satisfied and able to provide for their families, then great. And if not, we should fix that problem.
Rather than somebody on you know, the roasting and deciding that $2 a pound or $3 a pound is, like, yeah, that's going to solve all the problems. Like, it's more about creating a space where people can live out their ambitions, whatever those ambitions may be. Right. Which, as romantic and nice as that sounds, it's probably even friggin' harder, man. Like, totally. It's right. Like, I really don't know. And I wish I had the time to kind of get more connected with a broad swath of people on the producing side of coffee to ask them, you know, are you materially satisfied? Are you able to seek out the type of life that you want? Like, how do you feel?
I don't know. Right.
You know?
No.
Or maybe these existential questions haven't occurred to some people because it's just a matter of figuring out material security or food security or something like that. Like, okay, if that's the case, what needs to happen to like take care of that level of needs, right? Like, it's so context dependent that like, I don't think it's even fair to talk about all of coffee. Yeah,
you could take any specific family and they'd have a different answer. So what kind of changing gears here?
Yeah.
Do you, on the like shipping logistics side of things, I know you have a decent understanding about that. And that's something that, I mean, probably is not what I'm really talking about, but like, I hate paying for shipping and it's just one of those weird things that for a small roaster though, it has been problematic starting out because like, I don't buy pallets of coffee at a time.
Yeah.
And that's partially a planning thing, also a capital thing. Like I don't go into debt to get coffee. I operate on a cash flow system. So like, if I have the money, I'm going to get the coffee. And I like to keep coffees rotating so that there's new coffees coming in and that the crop is fresh and that I don't just have 10 bags that I roast through throughout the year. So that's a personal preference that I've decided to make. But like when I have to pay $130 or $150 for shipping for bags of coffee, I'm like, dude, like that's...
Dollar a pound?
Yeah.
Like a dollar, like, yeah. Like literally, you know?
Like,
that might be 25% or like 20% of the value of your coffee. I can totally see how that's a nuisance, right? Because no value is added.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, no perceived value is added. Yep. You could argue that value was added in that an efficiency was gained by moving a product somewhere from somewhere where it's not useful to somewhere where it is useful to you. But that's some textbook esoteric nonsense. Like from your perspective, the coffee didn't get 25% better being shipped to you.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
If anything, they might have torn the bag open and made it a little bit worse.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Dude, I hate it because the only good answer I have for you is scale. And even with scale, there become limits and trade-offs, right? Like as you mentioned, you could buy 10 bags of coffee and let it sit in your warehouse for a year. Mm-hmm. And by the time you're on the 8th, 9th, 10th bag of that coffee, it tastes like cardboard or it's starting to show age. Yep. And like suddenly your brand image is suffering because you as a roaster, you're pulling your hair out to like squeeze some good flavor notes out of this coffee. And your customers are kind of like, hey, when you sold this to me back in February, it was banger.
Yeah. Now, right.
Like, now I have to brew it twice every day because I feel like I'm messing something up. And like, really, it's that the coffee was showing age and they're brewing just fine.
Right? It's not like, the paper filter taste you're getting here. It's way off.
Yeah. Don't keep rinsing your filter. You're going to tear a hole in the thing. Dude, I wish I had a good answer. I mean, so you mentioned that the scene in BV is like, you know, kind of closed off. And to be honest with you, I have no idea what the roasting scene in BV is or in many of the other mountain towns, but like perhaps there are other people on a similar scale that are facing the same problem you are.
Yep.
And if you guys threw a pile together, threw a few bags together, you could cut down the shipping cost and like, maybe it'll mean that you got to hop in the car and drive up to Vail to pick up a few bags from somebody else's warehouse. But like,
yeah, at the end of the day,
you can do the math on what the gas price is that day and whether or not it makes a difference, right?
Like, right. And
yeah,
I think that's a great option for people. A lot of people reach out to me. They're like, hey, I'm starting a new roastery. Like, where should I buy coffee? And like, what are those things? And, you know, I often point them to places that I'm like, here's what I've found out, right? Like, Olam, like specialty importers, does a good job. Their shipping price has gone up like, kind of recently, but you could get a 60 kilogram bag for like $100. And that was like, I think it's now 100. It used to be cheaper than, I think it was like 70. And I was like, that was like pretty reasonable for me because I could, you know, calculate the cost and it was still affordable and all those things. And then like Genuine Origin does a good job because they just include it. It's smaller boxes, like, and those kind of things. Yeah. And so,
Okay. What you're pointing at is actually a good thing that I failed to consider, but it's totally valid. If you pay for shipping through your importer, you're taking advantage of the fact that they have the scale discount on their shipping rates, right?
Right.
Like they've got an account with whatever shipping company they may choose to use, and they move enough volume that like they're going to get a discounted rate, probably mark it up a little bit and pass it on to you. But even that little bit that they're going to mark it up is might still get you a better rate than if you independently hit up the shipping company and we're like, moving one bag this month, like,
yeah, totally.
You know, that should be right. Like on a micro scale, if I go to the FedEx store and I got one package to ship that weighs 100 pounds, they're going to charge me an exorbitant amount of money. Right. But if I'm, some large scale online retailer, like let's say I'm Vans Shoes and I've got an account with FedEx, a 100 pound box, same 100 pound box, might be a third of the price under my discounted, like negotiated rate because of the volume that that FedEx knows I'm going to move with them. Right. Like, so that is another, I guess, way you could, go about
it. Yeah.
I will say on that same note, like if one of the things I learned at Strava was the value of, freight forwarders and freight brokers, freight brokers is a better way to put it. Someone like Unishippers, what they'll do. So these people are kind of they're brokers, they're middlemen, and you can hit them up and say, hey, I need to move a pallet from here to there, and they'll hit up a whole bunch of different shipping lines, give you a bunch of different prices and transit times and coordinate everything for you. Right. When I was at Strava, I naively didn't know to take advantage of these types of brokers who are able to negotiate with a bunch of different lines based on the volumes. And I was just like, I'm going to make this easy on myself and it's all going UPS. I'm going to call up the UPS rep. Yeah. I'm going to make an account and it's going to be like, it's going to be super easy. And while that reduced the amount of mental effort I had to put into moving shipments, I rapidly discovered that I didn't always get the best rate from UPS because I just wasn't in a volume tier where it made sense. Right. And so,
Fascinating. Yeah. It's I don't know. I keep coming back to this idea. Like I wish there was and maybe these companies that I've listed are already doing it, right? And they discovered this idea. But I wish there was a way to get with importers that truly are making an impact on the producing level and get it to a scale that makes sense to where, like, you're buying in bulk, you're then essentially breaking down to smaller quantities and then have an accessible entry point to where people then can, you know, affordably purchase and buy that aren't doing massive quantities, you know, and get the direct trade, direct relationship type feel.
I'm blanking on it, but there are one or two people in the industry I've come across who are doing this. The first one that I can think of is, I think it is Sweet Maria's.
Yeah.
But they do partial bags, to my knowledge, mostly for home roasters. But if they're cracking bags open and selling fractions of them, there might be something there.
Right. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know for sure. But I came across it somewhere else, and
there's a couple places that do it that I know of. But like Genuine Origin does. How big are they? 65 pound boxes.
Okay.
And like their shipping's included in the cost, and like, you know, I've found really good quality coffee with them, which has been great. But anyways, it's an interesting, I think it is reassuring your answer of like, hey, if they're continually getting quality coffee, that is essentially putting money back into the producers, in the pickers, and all the layers that go into the processing and the milling, like that money is going back to the right people. I wish there was And Onyx does a good job of their marketing of like, hey, this is where, this is what we bought the coffee for. This is the like green coffee, like this is the market rate. This is what we bought it for. This is what we're selling it for. And again, like Onyx's marketing is just really good. And
now I know the transparency reports you're talking about, and I've been genuinely impressed with them.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
and it is cool. I wish that was like more accessible, because they've just done a good job of figuring that out. But it's like, I wish I knew, like, hey, this is what. And again, I just don't think people want to show that, right? Like, I don't think the importers want to say, like, hey, I got this coffee that I'm selling to you for $5 a pound, for $3 a pound, because then that means that we, you know, the people that sold the coffee for $3 a pound are only, you know, like, you then start seeing, like, whoa, like, this coffee really at its core isn't that expensive. It's just everyone whose hands get on it gets a piece of the pie, which is just an unnecessary evil, but it's legit, right? Like, that's just how, you know, supply chains work. But I wish there was easier access to that kind of information so that people could be better educated. So
for sure. And it, but also I for sure fall into a trap of like getting a piece of that information and thinking I am in a position to make a judgment and then misjudging it. You know?
Yeah.
So it gets tricky there, right? Cause then that introduces this whole other mess, and there's probably somebody who's going to watch this and pick up some piece of what I've said and nail it as just exactly that, right? Like something I came across so far that I spouted an opinion on and actually have misjudged because I'm lacking context.
Right.
So like, yeah, making that information available and then contextualizing it so that it's meaningful and taken the right way. Yeah.
But at the end of the day, man, like that's what I enjoy about like long form podcasts, is because without these conversations and access to this information, like you can't have these back and forth things where like people can check you on the information, right? Like I'm ignorant to a lot, to be honest, right? Which is why I wanted to interview people that know more than me. And, you know, someone out there is going to know more than you, but at the end of the day, like these, I know it's crazy to think, but it's probably true.
A lot of them.
No, but like those conversations are what further our industry, right? Like that free flow of open conversations. And I did really appreciate, I talked with Andrea, the owner of Onyx, and she was so keen on like, hey, these conversations have to happen and we have to come back together. Like COVID and everything, like politics, and there's just so much that's divided us. Like we've got to be able to come back together. We may not agree on everything, but at the end of the day, these conversations are important because we may not be wrong, but the fact that we're willing to sit down and talk is what furthers the industry, what furthers, you know, community and an openness to that. And, you know, I think that I really hope specialty coffee can continue doing that, because like screw the snobby vibe, screw the we know everything and that we're doing right by everyone. Like at the end of the day, like let's just continue to try to progress and learn more as we go and sell coffee to people that want to buy the coffee, right? Like it's okay that people want to buy Folgers and Starbucks and McDonald's coffee. Like I have no problem with that, or dump a bunch of cream, sugar and flavoring in it. If you want to find value in coffee, great. Like come to me and let's learn about it and dive into it. And if not, like kudos, you know, like nothing wrong with that. So
For sure. I get, I'm with you, man. The hard game to play is to find the ways to like, you know, drive value through every channel that coffee moves.
Right. Last thing I want to cover with you is roasting maintenance and that kind of thing. It's overlooked. I'm probably guilty of it myself, but just like, there's not like, how do you clean it? How do you maintain it? It's this massive machine, you know?
I guess if it's got a fan, clean it.
Okay.
If there's like, you know, there's a whole bunch of different roasters out there, right? Like at this point, I've worked on three different probats, a Giessen and a Loring, which is a very small sample, but
yeah,
a sample nonetheless, sure, of what's out there from 5 to 70 kilos. And what I've found is that your cooling tray fan gets filthy. Mm-hmm. Your exhaust fan gets filthy. On some roasters, those are the same thing.
Right.
Your cooling tray fan and your exhaust fan.
Yeah, like so, Dietrich's.
Like, yeah, yeah, exactly. So if it's got a fan, look into finding a way to clean that. Your cooling tray is probably full of chaff. There's probably a way to clean that. Most of the roasters that I've worked on, whether it's like straightforwardly obvious or not, there is a way to disassemble the mixer and the sieve in your cooling tray, mm-hmm, get in there and get all the chaff and that sort of stuff out, right? There's probably a duct that goes from your cooling tray to whatever fan pulls air through your cooling tray to cool your coffee off. That ducting is probably full of the same chaff. Right. So check that. You probably got a smokestack where smoke goes, like, gets pushed by the fan, be it the exhaust or cooling tray fan, up and out the building. There's these things called chimney brushes, mm-hmm, that are incredibly valuable. Grab a chimney brush. If it's not reasonable to get up on the roof, find a way to like disconnect your smokestack inside the building, and you're going to get filthy. You're going to look like a chimney sweep because you're literally sweeping the chimney.
Yeah, that's exactly,
but you got to sweep the
doing
chimney, dude. Like, yeah, 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 it's exactly what you're doing. You got to open up the airflow in that chimney. And like doing this stuff on a regular basis, like, it's going to suck. If you've never done it, it's going to suck the first time you do it. It's going to be tough to figure it out, and you might mess some stuff up.
Right.
So, like, you know, like, I've messed some stuff up working on roasters. I've had times where I've had to figure it out. The first couple of times I had to figure stuff out, it was tough. I learned some lessons there that made it a little bit faster, yep, the next times I had to figure stuff out, right? Because there's, like, once you kind of get the idea of working on stuff, like, some of the principles of working on stuff or taking things apart continue through the different things that you work on. So yeah, find your smokestack, find a way to get your chimney brush into your smokestack, and clean that thing out, get the soot out of it. And once you've got it clean, do that regularly, because the more regularly you do it, the more consistent your airflow is going to be. Mm-hmm. If you keep your airflow consistent, your roasting is going to be consistent.
Yep.
I assume you want your, like, everybody wants their roasting consistent.
Right.
Yeah. Like that's the assumption behind that. But yeah. And like, it's, you know, you gotta let it go pretty far to get to this point. But once your roaster gets to a certain level of dirty, like, you run into fire risks. Right.
Yeah.
So we've got your cooling tray. We've got all your fans. There's probably a cyclone on your roaster that collects chaff. If you're not emptying your chaff regularly, you've probably set your roaster on fire already. So empty your chaff regularly.
Yeah,
nice. But also, like, look at the nooks and crannies that your chaff goes through before it gets into that chaff can, because those nooks and crannies, all those places where air moves, are probably dirty too.
Yep.
So clean those as well. Clean the surfaces of your cooling tray, because coffee's a food product and your food product touches those surfaces, and just, like, keep that, I don't know, wipe it down with rubbing alcohol, keep it from building up,
yeah,
too much, like, gunk and grime. I don't know, maybe, yeah, keep the cooling tray nice because you can. So, like, those are, like, the basic things, right? Keep chaff and creosote from building up in places where it's going to pose a risk, or build up to a point where it's going to be nearly impossible to remove in the future. And if you have a bunch of built up creosote somewhere that's impossible to remove, putty knives and gasket scrapers. Grab a putty knife from Home Depot, a gasket scraper from AutoZone, or maybe a couple different sizes of gasket scrapers from, mm-hmm, AutoZone, and those will chip away stuck creosote really well. Do that kind of stuff. And then if you've got all of your dusty, creosote-y, chaffy stuff clean, take a look at your bearings. Anything that spins probably has a bearing. So your drum bearing, your cooling tray stirrer, your fans, those all have a bearing somewhere. That bearing's getting really hot, and the grease in that bearing is probably getting eaten up. Mm. Talk to your roaster manufacturer. See if they have a recommended grease. I've played some fun games with grease, and found that some of the stuff you can use isn't quite heat resistant enough. So while your bean probe might tell you that you never break 450 degrees Fahrenheit, it might be the case that the surface temperature of your bearing actually gets to 500. And yeah. So when you're buying grease, make sure that the grease you're buying can tolerate the amount of heat. And if you're not sure, dude, it's like, it gets gnarly complicated, but most of the companies that produce greases and that sort of thing have these huge tables of like all the different properties of their grease and like the viscosity at different temperatures and like the maximum temperature where the grease starts to degrade and break down.
Yeah.
And so like, that's the kind of key data point you're looking for there. Chances are your roaster manufacturer will be able to guide you through some of that basic stuff. Although I will say, if your manufacturer is like not based in the same country you're in, it can be hard sometimes to get that information. Or if you have a particularly old roaster, like a UG22 from the 60s, it might not be immediately obvious. Like,
right,
there might not be a how to. Shout out to Probat. They actually did walk me through a decent bit of stuff on one of the UG that I worked on. So that was cool because that roaster is way out of production. Like, they don't make that anymore, but they still provided support on that. So keep dust from building up in your fans and your cooling tray and your ducting, and check your bearings, make sure those are greasy. That's kind of the day to day to keep things spinning and working happily.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Super good, man.
I know.
Well, Kyle, anything else you want to leave us with before we wrap things up?
I've probably said too much already.
Dude, no.
I think
this conversation is just super important, right? Like, I don't think people get a chance to really get a peek into what that number on top of their website they go to actually means, right? Like, oh, that's the market. Great. Like, you know, it's like, oh, that's the stock market. Like, a lot of people just don't understand what actually drives that. And
yeah,
I think it's a fascinating look into some of the problems that people are so focused on fixing and on getting an understanding of what's actually going on and the questions that we need to be asking and hopefully, you know, finding some answers. So, you know, hats off to you for seeing all the sides and actually going to Origin and being, you know, actually get an inside view of like, hey, I have these ideas, but I'm actually going to live it out. And so that's awesome, man.
That's the goal, man. I've had some intuitive impulses and I want to see what's actually there, what's going on, you know?
If
you're going to say that the C market's not awesome and we got to not let people in suits decide the price of coffee, at least my approach has been to figure out what the people in suits are actually doing.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So,
maybe let them do their thing. We'll do our thing. And, you know,
exactly. Like, maybe what they're doing does have an important role in the industry. And like, okay, if that's the case, let's acknowledge it and see how we can work in that context.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, no longer let it be a limiting factor.
Right.
For sure. Yeah. So no, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. It's been kind of fun to explore these topics. Hopefully, you know, this gets the wheels turning for other people. Thanks for having me on, man.
Absolutely, cool. Kyle. I'll be sure to put your Instagram handle in the podcast notes and stuff. So if people want to reach out to you or have more questions, if you're cool with that, they can reach out.
Me know what I got wrong here.
Yeah, for sure. And let's get the conversations going, right? Like, you know, I'm the same way. I love when people reach out to me with questions and I'm an open book. Like, I'll share anything with anyone at any time, because I think that's what makes our industry better. So Kyle, thanks so much for coming on the show today, man. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and enjoy your time down in Mexico.
Thanks for having me, man. All right. Best to you.